Hello, I'm Kieran Fowley.
And I'm Kate Fowley.
This is Friday Night at Blockbuster, the podcast about our favorite movies from the 2000s. Before we get into this week's movie, though, I think it's time for another challenge.
I feel like it's always time for another challenge with you, though.
I could give you a challenge every week. Like, let's be honest here. I could give you a challenge every week. I do this as a courtesy to you.
Give me a little break.
Yeah. But this is going to be the biggest challenge we've given you yet. And some of that is our mother's fault.
Yeah.
She kind of jumped in with a suggestion that I was like, oh, that is a great suggestion. So I was like, well, you're doing both now.
Yeah, you came up with one, she came up with one, and it was, well, you might as well do two.
Yeah.
On top of the movie that we're going to watch as well next week, so.
Absolutely. If I can do it, you can do it.
Yeah.
Our schedules are the exact same.
Exact same. Full-time jobs.
Yeah.
Little one at home. Yeah. Sure.
So, next week's challenge, we're going back to the 60s again, trying to pull you.
We're breaking that pre-1990 yeah, bias.
We're getting you to go back and watch some older classics. We were sort of here talking the other day, and I was reminded, or we were talking about your reaction to Unforgiven and this Western that, you know, it's not really a genre that you grew up watching like I did and things like that. And you were kind of, you were wanting some things from the movie that the movie wasn't obviously giving you. And so with that in mind, I was sort of like, well, you should then probably go back and watch one of the great Westerns, one of the iconic Westerns. And so I said, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Mere seconds before Mom jumped in and said, Butch Cassidy, the yeah. Sundance Kid. And I said, oh, great one. So we're giving you both.
Isn't it great, everybody?
I think more people will probably know of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly just for reputation's sake.
And that's the thing. So when I looked them up, Butch Cassidy, obviously, I've heard the name
yeah.
around. I know quite literally nothing about that story at all. But The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I was like, I think I've seen this.
You definitely
have. And Kieran was immediately like, well, what's the story? And I was like, I don't remember, but like, I remember the title and even kind of looking at the poster. So I'm curious to see when I start to watch it, if maybe I've seen clips online, if I've seen scenes.
Yeah. I think there will be immediate recognition on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Because that's how it was for me. So the first time I watched it, and we'll get into a little bit more next week, but the first time I watched it, when Morricone's score starts at the very beginning of the movie, I was sitting there I was like 14 or 15, and I was like, oh my God, that's this movie.
Oh, okay.
I knew I hadn't seen the movie, but I instantly recognized the music.
Yeah.
And then there are parts in the movie where you're just like, oh my God, that's where that comes from.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious to see, like, yes, you may have seen clips, you may have seen references to Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So I'll be curious to sort of get your full
take. What I kind of draw from.
Yeah, get your full take. I have sort of long said, and I've heard other people say, that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid may be one of the earliest examples of a true modern movie. So okay. Like, even though Butch Cassidy is from 1969,
it's a modern movie.
Well, it's like, it's shot and it's edited and the actors are acting okay. in a way where you're sort of like, oh, we're still doing that.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, you've now watched a few movies from the 60s. You've watched a few movies from the 50s and things like that, that I've gotten you to check out. You can tell a difference.
Yeah.
You can see that they are put together differently than what we do now. I think you'll be happily surprised and impressed and whatever with Butch Cassidy, because it's been a few years since I watched it, but my memory of it is like, oh, this thing really fucking moves. The acting is exactly what we've had for the last 40 years. Like, these guys were just the first people to do it.
Yeah.
And like, it's really funny. It's really, really funny. Me and Mom were obviously talking here, and it's Paul Newman and Robert Redford, like two of our favorites. And yeah, so we had to give you both. We have to give you both.
I don't think you had to, but
No, it was not really up for debate. We had to give you both. So yeah, I watched The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly already before watch or before
this episode,
before recording this, and I was just in there being like, I think she'll like parts of it. You know, it is 3 years older than Butch Cassidy, so you can sort of tell. It's also, it's not a Hollywood movie. It's one of these spaghetti westerns that we talked about. So there is obviously big differences, but there were moments where I was like, the attention may wander here for a minute or two. Whereas with Butch Cassidy, I hope and I imagine that you'll sort of be like, oh my God, like that breezed by.
I think just before we started to record as well, you kind of looked at me and you're like, you have a lot of movie to watch.
Yeah.
Because the runtime of the three movies are all quite long for next week. So
only Butch Cassidy comes in under 2 hours, which
yeah.
Again, like how, I don't know how they pulled that off, but they did somehow. Just like any sort of thoughts or feelings or whatever about like what you think they're going to give you, what you think the movies might be about.
I'm hoping because of my reaction to Unforgiven that this is going to be more the traditional Western. So maybe a standoff, maybe a nice little tumbleweed, somebody dressed in all dark clothes who's clearly the bad guy, somebody in all light clothes who's clearly the good guy. Like, I'm looking for a little more classic Western imagery. So
okay, what I can sort of say is like the good, the bad, it's gonna give you all of it.
Okay,
it's gonna give you all of it. Like, despite the fact that it's a spaghetti Western, they were trying to make American Westerns just okay. in Europe. Just one note with that. You will have to somehow overlook the dubbing process because a lot of the actors on set were Italian actors.
Oh, lovely.
And so they obviously spoke Italian and he just came in afterwards and would record English speakers for those parts. And so like the lips never line up.
So I've started to get better with subtitled movies and branching out the dubbing movies. I like
you see, it's very very noticeable, and it'll sort of for the first 5 minutes you'll be like, oh God, you do.
I get used to it.
Get into step, okay. Especially with him. Like, he does cut around it as best as he possibly can, but it was just the way that they put these movies together. He recorded no sound on set, and so he would just film
the what movie, they were doing,
and then he would put the sound in afterwards. And so, like, even Clint Eastwood or Eli Wallach, like, English-speaking actors who are in the movie, their lips don't necessarily match what they're saying because they didn't have their dialogue recorded on set.
Okay.
They would speak the lines, and then they would come in afterwards and dub everything back in. So you'll have to overlook that.
Okay.
It's a unique aspect of the whole spaghetti Western thing. But, and then specifically with Butch Cassidy, they are like, they're real people, they are real American icons.
Okay.
And so the movie does play up this sort of mythology that has surrounded them, because like they were train robbers and bank robbers and things like that, so like you'll obviously get that. But the movie then has this like really kind of strange and wild and like out of left field turn halfway through, because that's what their story was.
Okay.
And so I remember the first time watching it being like, did this actually, like, is this how this went? And you're sort of like, oh, that's exactly how it went. And it's just like, it's not typical of your Western stories. Okay. But I think
I'm intrigued.
Combined, they will give you what you're looking for.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
If I will say, if they're not what I want, that might be the end of the Westerns for Kate.
Well, there's a couple in this decade we might have to talk about, but We can move on. We can move on to this week's episode. And so this
Which week, is not a Western.
It is definitely not a Western. It is kind of an anti-Western in every single possible way. But we are going back to February 13th, 2007 to talk about Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette. We did Lost in Translation.
Yep.
Sort of early last year. Kind of wanted to try and find another one. I hadn't realized that you'd watch this so recently. You only watched this back in, I think, July or August?
Yeah.
So was that just on, like, a random thing? Or were you looking to watch more of her movies? Or had you seen this before?
Like, so I had seen this before, and I knew that I liked it before, and I don't think at the time of doing Lost in Translation, I realized it was the same person.
Yeah, well, you also didn't realize at the time of Lost in Translation that yeah. she was related to Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah, I don't think we need to bring up that point again. It's been made very clear to me by multiple people that that was a lapse in understanding of movie history. Now I know better. But I don't think, after watching Lost in Translation, I couldn't believe that she did
this
yeah. and that.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I need to go back and watch Marie Antoinette to see if there was like a thread that connected them. Is it the same story? Did I imagine a different story in my head? And so, yeah, it was just one day I think I found it on streaming, or I had seen a clip online or something, and I was like, oh, that's what I'm going to watch this week. I'm going
to seek that out.
Yeah.
This time around, a bit unique for us, we both got to see this on the big screen because it was playing at our local movie theater.
But not at the same time.
We didn't go on the same day. We didn't go at the same time. I went down the first night. You went down the second night. Just very quickly, packed both nights.
Oh, yeah.
That is awesome.
I was really surprised because you had come over after your viewing and said, oh, I rolled in 5 minutes early, which is what you tend to do. And the lobby was packed and all the seats were pretty well full up. And so me and Mom obviously went the second night together. And I said, like, we need to make sure we're down there early so that in case it is really busy, we actually get halfway decent seats and make sure we actually get seats. Because I got a little nervous that maybe we wouldn't have. So, but yeah, no, super busy. In one of our, in our showing, we had people like dressing up. We had somebody in Marie Antoinette's style. She had done
without a head or something? Like,
no, she had a flower crown.
Flower
crown and like
all dressed. It would be more impressive if somebody showed up headless.
Well, that wasn't in this movie though.
Oh, so. That's true. That's fair enough.
But yeah, no, it was kind of the decision for us to do this episode this week was because Playhouse was putting it on.
And it had been a few years since I had seen it. And I, like you, I'm also just a big Sofia Coppola fan to begin with. But like you, I had fond memories of being like, that was a really good movie. And,
Yeah. You
know, her like whole take on it, which we'll get into here, is like not typical. And so when I saw it, that it was coming to the Playhouse, I was like, well, I definitely want to see it on the big screen because like, why not? That would just be fun. And then, yeah, like I was just like, it makes me so happy that they're showing a 17-year-old movie and it's like a packed theater.
Yeah.
That makes me so happy that people are sort of like getting it and they're figuring out, I'm going to have to start showing up 10 minutes early instead of five. But, you know, that's a small concession to make. But do you think that the reason I was kind of bringing up the movie theater thing is, do you think seeing movies on the big screen, does it stick in your mind a little bit more? Can you, like, it's obviously very fresh for us, but do you think you'll be able to sort of remember it better because you've seen it on the big screen?
Sometimes. I find in a movie theater, because there's no other distractions, I'm not thinking about other things. So I'm not sitting there being like, oh, I should probably switch the laundry, or oh, we should probably turn off the dishwasher. Because there isn't any of that. You are in a dark theater. The only thing to focus on, hopefully, is the big screen. I got pretty lucky. We didn't have any kind of annoying...
No, the crowd down there is like almost always exceptional. Almost always.
And stuff, that would be the only thing that would take me out of kind of the atmosphere, the feelings of it all. But yeah, I find I do tend to remember movies more if I've seen them on the big screen. That being said, for some history movies, I like being at home.
Because Google?
I like to be able to Google. Because I know roughly the story of Marie Antoinette, I didn't feel like I needed to do that at the time. But recently, I just watched the Napoleon movie, and I found during it, I was pausing it and looking things up because I needed to know kind of, well, what brought him to that scene or different things like that. So
Napoleon's interesting because, not least for the fact that this movie basically ends with Napoleon rising. Like,
yeah.
If there was five more minutes of this movie, Napoleon would probably make an appearance. But it's also interesting in the way that I think the Sofia Coppola and Ridley Scott have like approached the subjects, because within the opening seconds where we get a Gang of Four song, like an 80s pop punk song, you're like, oh, she's not trying, this is not a biography. This is not a typical period piece drama. She doesn't, like, she probably does care about the history. She probably does care about presenting certain things in a certain way. But also, she's making a radical choice to not sort of be like, this is going to be Barry Lyndon. This is going to be, you know, whatever royal family drama you've watched a million times. This is not that. I think Ridley Scott is doing the exact same thing with Napoleon, where he's trying to sort of take the character of Napoleon, the person of Napoleon, the mythology of Napoleon, and sort of be like, yeah, but I'm just going to have fun with it. But because he doesn't push it as far as Sofia Coppola does, you get stuck in that middle ground of, but is he trying to tell me the actual story, or is he just sort of fucking around? Because with her, with Marie Antoinette, I have way more leeway to sort of be like, oh, it's just fun. Like, I don't really care if I come out of this movie knowing it. Like, I could not write an essay on Marie Antoinette after watching this movie, but I kind of don't care.
I would agree that you can't write an essay. What I like is Marie Antoinette's big life events are there. So the fact that she gets married young, the fact that her and Jason Schwartzman, Louis, kind of have an awkward start and don't end up having a kid for 8 years, that's there. The fact that I'm sure being an Austrian woman coming to France, she probably wasn't very liked and stuff. So, like, the big life events for me are important, and if they had messed with those, I wouldn't have enjoyed the movie. All of the filler things, so, like, her having the parties and stuff like that, sure, take liberty. Have her drinking until 3 a.m. and have her gambling and all that stuff. Because maybe she did that. She probably had some form of that. But that's not important details to me. The true historical facts are what are important to me. And I think she did a good job at, like, preserving those.
I think most of it comes down to the music. And I'm going to, like, put you on the spot. You don't pay attention to music all that much. I'm going to put you on the spot. Music is a big thing in this movie.
Music is a big thing.
But yeah, I think what you're saying is, like, is right. But it comes down to the fact that she is using pop music from the 1980s during these big scenes. We're sort of like, don't take this serious.
Yeah.
It's not, you know what I mean? Like, this is not to be meant to be taken serious. This is not going to be in the pantheon of, you know, great, great work with a, you know, great female performance at the center of it, even though I think Kirsten Dunst is pretty great in it.
Yeah.
But, like, that's not what they're aiming for. And so the music goes a long way in signifying, like, just relax. It's a, like, we're just here to have a good time.
I would agree. Are all the songs from the 80s, though?
Most of them.
Okay, because I was going to say, I recognized one and I didn't think it was an 80s song.
Well, what song do you recognize?
Like, Candy. Because it was sung by Aaron Carter. And so I know that Aaron Carter.
Oh, yes. The original is from the 80s, I think. Yes.
It's always the one. So I think when I first watched Marie Antoinette, I don't know how many years ago, I recognized, or I knew that songs and music played an important part. Because it's a historical movie, but kind of with contemporary music in a way.
Yeah. It's very similar to A Knight's Tale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that. When I went back and rewatched it, though, last year, I was sitting there being like, I felt like I recognized a lot more of the songs however many years ago that I watched it. And so it was interesting when I went back and watched it this time that I was like, oh no, I actually don't know many of these songs at all. But I think because I've heard them in this movie, I think I know what they are.
Right. So. Right. Yeah. They are sort of like, maybe with the exception of Candy, a lot of them are like indie.
Okay.
Bands and like indie stuff, because that's kind of the scene that Sofia Coppola grew up in during the 80s and whatnot, and we'll get to why she's maybe chosen those songs. But yeah, I just think it would be strange. The Napoleon thing is just strange to talk about, because I don't think Ridley Scott hit the tone that he was maybe trying to go for. You
think he should have gone either more or less?
I think he should have. He obviously didn't want the movie to be like a Wikipedia article of Napoleon's life down to the minute details. He wanted to kind of fuck about. He wanted to, you know, have a good time with it. Everything with Napoleon and Josephine is like hilarious. It is so funny.
Yeah.
Is that true? Probably not. He gets bogged down then by the fact that he has to have these big battle scenes where it's sort of like, well, we know what happens. You can't really mess about with them.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think if he had a bit more of a satirical tone or a bit more of a loose tone, like the movie's kind of like, I don't like saying this, but I do like Napoleon, but it's like a little stuffy. It's a little stiff. And if it had just been a little bit looser, like Marie Antoinette is, I think he could have maybe gotten away with contemporary music in a way that this movie does, that A Knight's Tale does. Now, A Knight's Tale is maybe even more comedic than both of these movies. So there is maybe Marie Antoinette is the happy medium. But yeah, I think he got stuck a little bit trying to aim for different targets.
Yes.
Whereas Sofia Coppola with this is just firmly like, that's what I'm going for. And I think she nails it.
Yeah, I think so too.
I don't know how you want to break it down. Like, do we want to go favorite scenes, favorite moments? Like, what do you want to bring up? What watching it on the big screen,
what stuck out to me?
What stuck out to you to sort of be like, oh, fuck, that's awesome.
So I don't know if I would have said it before, but this watch through, Kristen Dunst and Jason Schwartzman's relationship and like awkwardness between the two of them, usually in the bed, were some of the best scenes.
They're just hilarious. Yeah.
Because they are both, and I had to kind of remind myself when I left to look up how old she was. She was supposed to be 15 when they got married. So you would be awkward. Like,
oh, she's a child. She's a straight child. Like, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Like, she is a kid and she's been shipped off to another country and married to a guy she's never met, who I then think is maybe a cousin in some relation.
Yeah, they're all related. Yeah.
And so I just love how awkward they both do it. And it does take them 8 years to have a kid, and you can slowly see them start to kind of like warm up to each other. Not even necessarily fall in love, because I don't know if it ever got to that point, but just like a friendship started to happen.
Yeah, yeah. I think, well, like we can jump into that right now, because I think you might be right. Like, my takeaway watching it the other night was like, oh, this is a loveless marriage in like more ways than one.
Yeah.
But I think by the end, and you know, I don't think this is true to Marie Antoinette's life, but it did in the movie, it takes her an affair to get here.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think by the end there is a like a respect. Like a sort of like, you know, he's doing as best as he can do, I'm doing as best as I can do. We've got to try and figure this mess out together. And there is like a level of respect there, even if it's not sort of an affection or an attraction necessarily. But I think it's like that on both sides.
Yeah.
Like, you could tell from those early scenes that, like, he's not necessarily happy to be here either. And, like, she's not. And they don't really know what they should be doing. Like, they probably do know what they should be doing, but, like,
neither of them want to do it. I think he would be a guy who, if he could have given up the throne, he probably would have, to make locks.
Yeah.
Because that's...
Yeah.
I think what...
Just like a quiet life.
Because he would have been next in throne based off of birth order.
Yeah.
And so I think if he could have given it up to one of the younger brothers, he would have been like, okay, I'm good. I'm just going to go be a locksmith and be happy over there. So...
Because I think the movie, there's a few scenes, but I do wonder if he just had like an overwhelming sense of like duty. Like, well, this is just what I have to do, so I'm going to do it. And like... But you can tell when he's going off on a hunt or when he's in the games room just like playing cards or whatever. Like, that's what he enjoys doing. That's what he'd rather be doing. And the scenes where he's with his advisors about, you know, they're talking about taxes or they're talking about sending aid to America and the revolution. He it's not that he's bored, but like, he just doesn't want to be there.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the fun part of being king or next in line is like what he wants.
Yeah.
But the political, like actual leading part, probably not. But yeah, so for Marie Antoinette, by the end of it, you kind of gather that she knows what her place is supposed to be. She's now had the couple kids and she knows she's the queen.
Yeah.
So like wherever he goes, she goes. So when they're trying to ship her off at the end of the movie, she's like, nope, I'm going to stay here with him.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
where
yeah.
I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
So I think they both have in their heads what the roles are supposed to be. Even if they're not necessarily happy with it, they know what the title is
yeah.
and they know what their responsibilities are because of said title.
And like all those responsibilities are just like, I forgot that the movie spends so much time with this, but those are just like drilled into her constantly
yeah.
by these letters from her mother. Sort of every 20 minutes in the movie, another letter arrives being like, you need to do this.
Yeah.
And you can just tell like the first part of the movie, she's supposed to be 15, 16 years old. You're like, this is way too much to be throwing on a 16-year-old. Like, can we ease up a little bit
on her? A 16-year-old who has no friends.
Yeah.
She wasn't allowed to bring her friends. She wasn't allowed to bring her dog.
Yeah, that's like inexcusable.
The only person she has is, and I'm blanking on what his name is right now, but the advisor.
Yeah.
Who...
played by Steve Coogan.
Thank you.
Yeah.
She kind of has him.
He's like the ambassador or something.
I think he's the ambassador. So, like, he's the only one who is probably kind of giving it to her a bit straight. But even then, he doesn't work for her. He works for her mom.
Yeah.
So, like...
Yeah. Like, she does, yeah, she eventually does find a crowd. Like, one of my notes here is basically, like, Sofia Coppola makes the French court system look like the high school cafeteria.
Yeah.
Like, she is the new girl walking in, and everyone has their cliques. And their groups, and it's all gossip and rumors. And, you know, you step out of line once, and that's all people are going to comment about. And she eventually does find her table
yeah.
with a couple people, like Rose Byrne and whatnot. But I also just love all the scenes with Molly Shannon and Shirley Henderson, where you just, like, overhear them in the background. Yes. Just, like, talking shit. And you're just like,
about everybody.
About everybody. Yeah, about everybody. But yeah, the sort of like they're the only two perfect ones in this little world, and everybody else is screwing up somehow. But like you put those two, and they're like the Waldorf and Statler Muppets. Like they're just hilarious, the two of them together. So
yeah, I enjoyed their scenes because the first meeting of Marie Antoinette and Kristen Dunst, they're kind of there being like, oh God, it's an Austrian, and she's gonna be so cold and stuff. And then you get a couple scenes where the three of them are together and you're like, oh, okay. They've like figured it out. They're going to be kind of cool with each other. And then a few scenes later, it's the two of them being like, oh God, she hasn't given us an heir. And like, it's just like, oh no, they're just going to gossip about everybody and anybody. So.
Well, yeah. Cause like, despite it being a high school cafeteria, like Marie Antoinette is like on one hand, the popular girl, but also on the other hand, the outsider.
Yeah.
Like, she is the princess.
And everybody wants to be her friend. Yeah,
exactly. Like, very soon she will be the most powerful woman in the country. But also she's this Austrian outsider that nobody likes.
Yeah.
And so you have to play nice when she's around. But as soon as she turns her back, the fucking daggers are coming out. I think the whole high school thing obviously goes to the fact that Sofia Coppola is treating this like...
a high school?
Like a high school teenage yeah. movie. Like... she quite clearly sees in Marie Antoinette this teen girl, and she's trying, I think, to link the fact that, like, teen girls are always teen girls. It doesn't matter when or where or how or whatever. Like, there are these common links that we can grasp at. And so, like, again, that goes to the music. Like, the music that she's putting in the movie is probably music that she listened to as a teen. There's obviously things in there, like, I don't know if you saw the shot, but there's a quick shot of Converse sneakers.
Oh, is there?
Yeah. So in in the sort of montage where Marie's going through, like, all the new clothes and the shoes and the
yeah.
the treats and all that sort of shit, I think this might be to Candy,
actually. Yeah, I think it's probably.
There is a very, very quick shot of her trying on a pair of shoes, And just in the background are two purple Converse sneakers.
Oh, nice.
And you're sort of like, that's kind of what I mean by the whole Ridley Scott thing. Like, she has a very, very clear vision of what she wants this movie to be. And I don't know if he had the exact same thing for Napoleon. But when you have that vision, you can get away with stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? She's putting shoes in there that are like 200 years from in the future. But it still kind of works. Yeah. It all kind of still comes together.
And it's just, yeah, because a 15, 16-year-old who now has access to however much money she was getting.
10 grand a month or something like that.
Something.
Or,
yeah. Like, yeah, you would be wanting to try on every shoe. Her wigs get more and more outrageous.
that one where, like, she gets the guy to come in and he, like, is putting roses and stuff in.
And birds.
And then she's like, oh, it looks great. And every time she moves, it looks like it's going to topple over. You're just like, good God. Like,
but what, not necessarily me, because I didn't necessarily have that friend group, but I've seen it in other movies. Like, that's such a big thing with hanging out with girls. Yeah. Trying on shoes, talking about fabrics. I'm sure there was probably boy talk that they just didn't include. Because that's what happens. You just kind of sit around and try on makeup and different things like that. So, yeah, I don't know if I necessarily saw until you kind of started talking about it on how much it is similar to a high school.
Yeah. That I've thought that for a while. Like, obviously, I can remember watching this when I was a teenager, sort of being like, oh, like, I've seen 50 other movies like this. They all just happen to be set in modern times.
Yeah.
But yeah, watching it the other night, I was just like, oh, yep, there we go. Like, there's the...
We're back in high school.
There's the montage of all, like, the girls at the tables. There's, you know, the montage of the boys and, you know, all that sort of shit. Like, her in her dressing room is, like, going to the mall, basically. Yeah. Like, except the mall, I guess, comes to her. But yeah, like, there's just a lot of things in there. And it's... It just goes to, like, the fun of the movie. Like, this is just a fun movie.
Yeah, I think my review the last year when I wrote it was just, it's a fun watch. Like,
I'm not trying to be serious.
I'm never going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
I'm never going to be disappointed putting it on and just having kind of, what is it, 2 hours to or something. Like, it's a good 2-hour watch. So.
I think with specifically Kirsten Dunst, I think actually this time, 2006, 2007, she was maybe coming out of, like, her peak fame. Like, if her peak fame was kind of the Bring It On, the Spider-Man era, like, that was a few years before this.
Yeah.
But to get her just sort of at the tail end, like, I don't think you've seen Virgin Suicides yet.
I have.
Oh, you have? Okay. Yeah. So, well, her and Sofia Coppola are obviously have had this lifelong creative partnership. They've made a lot of movies together. I don't think there was any question that she was going to be Marie Antoinette. Like,
no.
You could maybe question if she can pull off being a 15-year-old in the first couple scenes, but, like, that's neither here nor there. I don't really care about that. But I think, like, she's legitimately pretty great in this movie.
I think she does a really good job. Although, yes, maybe not 15. She plays young.
Yes.
The first few scenes.
Yeah.
And part of it is the clothes that they have her in. I know off of other stories and books I've read, like, if it was above the ankle, you were a young kid still. Once you got old enough, you would drop your hems and have it touch the floor. So, like, the costumes help with that. But I think you slowly start to see the change in her where she gets to be more comfortable in the court, or she at least pretends to be more comfortable. And she starts to make the friends. And by the end, you do kind of start to see her as a queen in that she cares about her friends. She cares about her kids. She cares about the husband. And, like, she knows that the best thing at the end of it is to leave, to try and protect everybody. So I think she does a good job at showing that arc of, like, development.
Well, that's, like, that's exactly what I was thinking. Because in the early scenes, you do see her as, like, really shy, really unsure of herself. She's not really sure of, like, the rules around the court, like who and when to talk and how to talk to certain people. We then obviously get that interaction with the king's mistress. I can't remember her name now.
DuBarry.
DuBarry, I think there was a movie just a year or two ago made about her.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
I sort of vaguely remember that. But we get that interaction with her. And I think that's like one of the first early indicators of like, oh, she's figuring this out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because so many people are being like, you have to talk to her. You have to talk to her. She's the king's mistress. But she can't talk to you. You have to talk to her. And so I think most people in that situation would sort of actually extend an olive branch and actually say something of substance. Whereas she just like, there's a lot of people here today.
Yeah.
And DeBerry's like, yeah, there is. And like that satisfies the talking to her, but it actually says nothing. And you're sort of like, oh, she's getting it. She's, you know.
Other people would have said, come join me for tea.
Yes.
Or
yes. There would have been an invitation for more.
I like your outfit. Yeah. I like your headpiece, yeah. Whatever. It would have been some form of a compliment or something.
But she gives her nothing.
But she was just, I'm stating a fact.
Yeah.
You can say yes to this.
Yeah, like. Exactly. Exactly. But like everybody's happy because she spoke to her.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's one of the early scenes of like, oh, she's getting it. She's like, she'll be fine. And then after that, you know, we get the whole, I think that's when they go off to Paris for the opera and things like that.
Yes.
And then you can sort of see her like influence starting to grow a little bit. And yeah, like by the end, she's like a loving mother, like a good partner to Jason Schwartzman. Politically, we'll get maybe into the politics. Maybe she's still a little naive at the end of the movie, but I think that's maybe true to life. But yeah, like I just think, despite the movie not taking itself seriously, she obviously took this role seriously because it is still a pretty significant historical figure.
Oh yeah, I think thinking about the politics now, I enjoyed that they included the clip of like her famous line, "Let them eat cake." And it's her reading it in a newspaper and being like, well, I never said that. Cause I want to know, like, did she actually, like, I enjoyed that. Yeah. They kind of took a different look at that particular line as if to be like, no, somebody else made it up. Like,
we could maybe, I don't know if you want to jump into that now. I have some thoughts about the way that, you know,
this was
all depicted.
Okay. Go for it. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's very obvious that Sofia Coppola doesn't really care about that.
No.
And, like, that's fair enough. Like, her focus is Marie Antoinette. That's the name of the movie. I think when we get to that point in the movie, because there has been almost no mention of what life is like outside of Versailles.
Yeah.
It is a little bit of a surprise to be like, oh, people are not happy? Like, France is kind of rioting and, you know, there are these like anti-monarchy, anti-royal family sentiments growing amongst the French population. And then when we get the let them eat cake line, because of the way that the movie kind of brushes it aside, being like, oh, like it's written in a gossip magazine.
Yeah.
Essentially. Like, you know, I didn't say that. Like, don't they ever get tired of reading these stories? And you're sort of like, oh, but like, did she say it then or did she not say it? Like, what, how does she feel about
the
political climate at the time? Like, is she aware of what's going on? Like, there are a few scenes and a few moments where the ambassador, Steve Coogan, is sort of being like, you know, there's a bread shortage and whatnot. And she's sort of like, well, like, have the person send us less diamonds.
Yes.
And you're sort of like, okay, like, I can understand that being the response of like a naive person, but is she actually naive or is it flippant or is it, you know, like what's really going on here?
Oh yeah. Cause there's another scene where she wants to buy trees.
Yes.
And she doesn't want to wait. She doesn't want to wait 3 years for them
to grow. Yeah.
So she wants medium sized trees.
Yeah.
And then somebody comes in and says, well, you've spent all your money for the month. And she's like, well, I'll buy the small trees and ask for more money. Yeah, I guess they don't kind of explore her political take.
Yeah.
That clearly, but.
And I think because Louis, Jason Schwartzman as the king, is such a side character. Like, if she's not interacting with him, we don't really hang out with him all that much.
Yeah.
We don't really get to see him doing anything. And so every time I watch the movie, I am always sort of taken by the fact that, oh, like, the French Revolution is like
happening.
It's like here. It's not even like slowly building in the background. It's just like all of a sudden it's there. It's at the gate. And you're sort of like, oh, like where did that come from? But because Sofia Coppola is not really interested in that, and like, fair enough, that's not what the movie's about. It does come as a bit of a surprise every time. And so I think, yeah, the let them eat cake line is sort of indicative of the, like, she's not even interrogating whether or not that line was said or, you know, where did it maybe come from? Like, there's just no, like looking under the hood of that aspect of Marie Antoinette, where we're still sort of focused on all the pretty colors and the frilly dresses and the masked balls and all that sort of stuff over here. We're not really looking at that.
Yeah, but I guess if, and like maybe you kind of said it without saying it or whatever, but because she doesn't look at the politics, like Marie Antoinette didn't look at the politics, when all of a sudden the mob is at their front door, it's kind of like, oh, they are there.
Yeah, like, yeah. And I think like once they're there, like there are a couple good moments and scenes where like she goes out to confront the crowd and like bows before them and stuff like that. And obviously we know how this all ends for her.
Yeah.
And so then I'm at least sitting there wondering, like, oh, if she just played this a little bit smarter, could she have gotten, like, could she have lived? Could she have convinced the crowd in some way that she was not the big bad guy that they obviously portrayed her as? Because there are a couple moments where you're sort of like, there's a bit of charm and there's a bit of maneuvering there. Like, could she have done something? The movie ends before we find out really what happened. But yeah, it's like an interesting sort of door that was not opened.
Yeah, because I'm trying to remember, like, I would know English history a lot more. So obviously she gets beheaded. But does Louis? No.
I think he does.
Does he?
I think he does because, again, this is not my strong area of expertise, but I am pretty certain that they basically get rid of this entire royal family and then they install a new like cousin of Louis.
Oh, okay.
For like a few years, basically before Napoleon, like Napoleon's already here kind of on the scene at this stage.
Yeah.
And the new king comes in for a few years and Napoleon basically comes in and usurps all power. Or with the help of other people. But yeah, slowly sort of starts taking over. And then the royal family's just gone.
Okay.
And that's that, right? I think one of the big takeaways I had watching it the other night, and this is maybe like the biggest theme of the entire movie.
Okay.
Was, so like, I was a bit surprised to be like, how did I not remember this? But it's just like how lonely and isolated she was and she is depicted as being. And it's obviously something that Coppola has come back to a few times over the years. And you haven't seen Priscilla yet, have you?
I have not. Okay. It was kind of on my list to watch.
Yeah.
So.
I think you should, because there's a lot of links, I think, between this and Priscilla in terms of the whole idea of, like, we think being a princess is great and fun and awesome. But actually, it can be quite lonely and quite isolating. And, like, obviously, Marie Antoinette is, like, a literal princess for most of this movie. Priscilla is, like...
American princess.
An American princess. She's a pop culture princess.
Yeah.
You know, Elvis was the king of rock and roll or whatever. But, yeah, it just sort of struck me because I've seen Priscilla, but I was also over one night a week or two ago. And Mum was watching Priscilla, and so I watched about half an hour. And I was sort of like, oh, like...
Oh, yeah.
She's a very lonely person in this movie. Like, that is the main takeaway of Priscilla, is that she was a very lonely person. And then watching Marie Antoinette the other night, I was like, there's a lot of scenes where she is by herself, sort of overwhelmed by the responsibility, overwhelmed by what she should be doing, and just nobody to talk to.
Yeah, I think... Once she has the kid and Louis gives her this, the house on clearly like the state, she isn't far, but she has her own place. And the fact that she's just happier there, she's happy without the big gowns. She just wants to be out in the garden with her kid and the goats and the honey and all of this different things. You are there just being like, oh, she also just in some ways maybe wants a quiet life. Like, if her and Louis could both just leave the court.
Well, that's kind of, they probably would have, they would have made common ground or, you know, had something in common if they'd just been like, yeah, I'd actually not like to be here.
Yeah. But
they'd
they'd
both be happy.
But they never had that conversation. But I think those are the scenes where you get to kind of see her, in some ways, her most happy is just this, like, common life that she wants to have.
And I think it's
so
because in those scenes, she's the most free. Like,
yeah,
she, you know, I don't think she's necessarily going that far out of the house, but she can go out of the house whenever she wants. She can obviously, you know, have people over here or there. She's just hanging out with her daughter. She's doing stuff in the garden. People aren't, like, micromanaging her life in the way that they had been when she was at court. And you're sort of like, yeah, maybe we just shouldn't have any of these institutions. Maybe everybody, you know, we don't need these things at all. Maybe is what we're getting at.
Kieran has very big views on the British royal family, but we'll skip that for a British movie.
Yeah, somewhere down the line. I think, like, obviously I understand what Coppola is saying about, you know, her life, and because of her duty and her responsibility and things like that, her life is not necessarily her own. And I can understand trying to make the comparisons to life in court being like a prison where you can't really go anywhere, you can't really do the things you want to do. I would counter that by saying, like, quite literally 99% of the French population would trade places with her in a heartbeat.
That's true.
So much so that they overthrew the royal family because they're just like, no, this is too much. So yeah, like, history would be on my side on that one, I think. But I think, like, Coppola does a good job. Like, Coppola obviously has a lot of empathy and sympathy for Marie Antoinette. And I think that does come across. Like, she makes you care about this person who the history books have told us was kind of a shit.
Yeah. Do you think Coppola identifies with being a princess in a royal family? Would the Coppola family be, like, royalty?
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think, yes, I think there are definitely some things that she can identify with in terms of coming up in this family that you, like, you didn't ask to be a part of, but there are expectations on you based on who your father was, who your grandfather was, who your mother is, who, you know what I mean? The Coppola family, especially in Hollywood, is so pervasive that if you're a Coppola who doesn't make movies, that's got to be weird. Like,
you're the black sheep of the family.
Exactly. Like, all of them make movies. So, like, obviously she has found her own voice and things like that. Like, there with her, I think the bigger thing would be, like, maybe the cloud of her father over her career. And, like, obviously we're living in a time of Nepo babies and, like, the whole idea of Nepo babies. Like, I think and I hope she's self-aware enough to know that, like, her name got her in a door somewhere and got somebody to look at a script that she wrote, where if she wasn't a Coppola, maybe that wouldn't have happened or not as happened as quickly as it did. But I think you can look at her career and her body of work and be like, she's a great filmmaker. Like, she knows what she's doing.
The name got her kind of in the door, but she's kind of stayed in the room because of herself.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. Like, nepotism will get you in the door, I think, but, like, talent keeps you there.
Yeah.
So, like, she clearly has that. But yeah, I think there has to be sort of that maybe voice in the back of your head sort of being like, am I that good?
Yeah.
And so obviously getting the awards and the recognition for Lost in Translation hopefully helped her. I think it's quite interesting that this movie is, like, so maximalist. Like, you were saying, you almost couldn't believe that it was the same filmmaker.
Yeah.
Because this is, like, this is not, like, some of the themes and the ideas and some of the style is definitely there, but this is her being like, fuck it, all of it's gone. You know, like, Lost in Translation's a bit quiet, it's a bit slow. So a bit minimalist.
I was kind of thinking about it just before we started to record, and I was like, I can start this time around, I could kind of see maybe some connections between the two. It does kind of follow one person. You kind of get to see her just live her life in some way. I think what's what kept my attention for this in comparison to Lost in Translation, though, is A, it's like a historical movie, which would always get me. The music helps. And then just like the bright colors and things
this
like that. Like,
it's in your face. This one's
it's
loud.
It's not subtle.
Yeah. This one's like, hey, look at me.
Yeah.
Look over here. Do we talk about Jamie Dornan at all?
Sure. Every time I forget he's in it.
I know.
Every time.
Yeah.
Looking at the cast list now, Tom Hardy's in it too.
Very, very small role.
Kind of forget about him too.
It's a blink and you'll miss him. I think Tom Hardy's like there in the background of a lot of stuff, but because it never gives you like a close up of him, you kind of don't see him.
Yeah.
But Jamie Dornan, he kind of plays the love interest.
Yeah, I would argue he's the love interest.
He's the love interest. He's at least the one that she's like physically attracted to in a way that she's not with Jason Schwartzman. But yeah, he comes in the second half of the movie. I don't know if Marie Antoinette had an affair with a Swedish general, but if she did, good for her.
Yeah.
Jamie Dornan is one of those guys that I'm still unconvinced if he's a good actor or not.
Okay.
But he's a great presence on like talk shows. So I do like him.
Okay.
Yeah, I do like him as a person. He's got some great stories. You just need to look up his like clips on Graham Norton. He's got some A+ stories.
But you're just not sold on him in his movies?
I don't know if he's a good actor. Like, I think he's a fine actor. But I don't know if he's ever going to be, you know, nominated at the Oscars or anything like
no?
that.
No?
No. We'll see. We'll see. But I don't know. I don't see it. But in this, like, you know, he comes in. He's supposed to be the hot guy.
He does a good job doing that.
He's a hot guy. So, fair enough, Jamie.
Because, yeah, he doesn't really talk a whole lot, I think. He doesn't
no,
kind
that's
of
probably
have,
his strength.
Yeah. He kind of doesn't have any big... They don't have any big scenes where they're connecting over no. something in common. It is just a physical thing. But yeah, no, the supporting cast is pretty wild in
pretty
this.
Pretty great. It's a pretty great cast.
Because so there's also James Lance, who goes on to be in Ted Lasso. He's the reporter in Ted Lasso.
Who is he in this movie?
He's the hairdresser.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, like, there's Rose Byrne, there's Molly Shannon, Shirley Henderson, Rip Torn. Rip Torn as the King of France is hilarious casting. It is so good. But this is what I'm saying. Sofia Coppola is clearly just fucking around having a good time. And that's what I wanted out of
Napoleon. And probably just reached out to people, said, hey,
you want to be in my movie?
Yeah.
You want to come to France for a bit? I think this is the movie where she met her husband.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So do you know the band Phoenix?
No.
They're like a French indie sort of synth rock band.
Oh, up my alley.
Yeah,
yep.
They're actually fantastic. But there's the scene where I think it's when she goes to like her own home with the baby, with the daughter.
Oh, okay.
And there's the quick scene where she's sitting in a chair and there's like four musicians.
Oh, yes.
Around. So that band, that is Phoenix. That is the band Phoenix.
Okay.
And Sofia Coppola's husband is the lead singer.
Okay.
I think he's the one who gives her the rose or the flower anyways. So yeah, that is her husband. So I think they may have met before this, but it's around this time that they got together.
And so might as well have the husband
absolutely.
In the movie.
Absolutely. Why not? Any sort of last closing thoughts, remarks, anything you want to say on Marie Antoinette?
I don't think so. I think because I've just watched Napoleon, it was kind of nice in a way to watch this again to kind of be like, okay, so how do we get to the beginning of Napoleon?
Yeah. Well, that's like, you could almost watch them back to back and it would seamlessly take you.
Yeah.
Like Napoleon starts mere minutes after Marie Antoinette ends, so.
Because, yeah, it is Marie Antoinette that gets beheaded at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Then I was trying to figure out, where would Les Mis work in all of this?
Oh, that is the revolution, isn't
it?
Yeah, so Les Mis would start 3/4 of the way into Marie Antoinette.
Well, there we go. Have 2 or 3 screens up and just watch these movies all at the same time.
Well, no, I don't think you need to watch Les Mis. You could probably give that one a skip. But the other two, yeah, you could definitely watch the other two.
You just want to skip it because it's a musical.
Yeah, I don't like it. Russell Crowe sings a lot in that movie, and we don't need Russell Crowe singing a lot. So, yeah, we don't need it. We don't need it.
Were there any final points that we didn't talk about for you
on your list? Not really. I just think, like, if you start your movie with Gang of Four, I'm in.
Okay.
That's a great way to start your movie. Sort of loud and, like, you know, pay attention. And then the masked ball with Susie and the Banshees.
Oh, yes.
That's a great
song. That is a good song, too.
That's a fucking great needle drop song. So, yeah, like, she's done this her whole career. She knows music inside and out. So, like, that didn't surprise me. But watching those on the big screen with the big sound, I was like, oh, it's never hit like that before. You know what I mean? So, those are two great moments for me. So, should we tease next week's movie?
The actual movie, not
the actual movie, yes.
Not my challenge.
Yeah, you got a big week ahead of you.
A first time watch again for me.
Yep.
But kind of been on my list to watch because I think it's something different than it's going to be. So.
Great tease, Kate. It's another historical set movie.
Mm-hmm. Not a Western, though.
Not a Western, but not far off of a Western. Maybe as we open the foreign language doors a little bit more, I can get some samurai movies in there. But basically, I've been watching Shogun and loving it. And I was sort of like, oh, we need to do this movie. So hopefully that's a good tease for people.
Okay.
But until then, we'll see everybody next week.
See you then.